something that I wanted to actually ask is, you talked about disruption and you sort of alluded to the S-curve of disruption, which is how companies shift from one S-curve to the other, and that is what actually constitutes disruption. I want to use that and ask you this. Are there any spaces in the education industry where you see disruption happening, and particularly by private companies? And what are those niche spaces that you think in the next 5 to 10 years will become huge, like huge markets?
Yeah, there's tons, and you should actually do an ed tech episode. We would love to. Who works directly in it. We'll find people for you, because I can again answer it from the sort of policy philosophy perspective, and a lot of the changes that I'm advising then become confidential. But you're right about that. There's an immense amount of disruption ahead. The disruption has been held back so far only because of the whole money angle. But for example, and I swear your batchmates are going to say that's not what AI means. But everybody in AI, everybody in education now pretends to be an AI shop, for example. Now, that's really interesting, right? And the morality question comes into it. If you know your student and their student progress from nursery all the way to higher education or even for lifelong learning, of course you can create a lot of scaffolding around the student building, because you have predictive technologies, right? You have predictive technologies that say that this is the way the student should be behaving for progress, or this is the natural way the student behaves, or this is the mental wellness ranking of the student or rating of the student. I mean, moving from those the marks that we used to get in exams, we're now going to move to mental wellness marks. I mean, that's too much pressure for any student.
That's actually happening?
That's actually pretty much happening. A state government has actually announced that we're going to introduce AI into managing our students' progress. Okay. So that's actually been adopted by the establishment. A lot of people think it's a very good idea. I have serious concerns about privacy. I have serious concerns about self-efficacy. I have serious concerns about free will as well, but we'll not go down the free will pathway. Well, I honestly, as a student, I would not want to be monitored for my bad moods. I am entitled to my bad moods, and I will fight my way through them, because that's the way we learn how to fight, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to be supported and scaffolded. My job as a student is to learn how to fight those miserable moments. Whether you got bad marks in your exam and somebody said, why did you get 9 out of 10? Why did you not get 10 out of 10? I mean, losing that one mark is misery. I say that as somebody who got 98 out of 100 in my class 10 board exams. I will never forget that misery or the shame of that. You know, I will never forget that, but I will also never allow that to happen again. And it's those moments that I don't want to be that scaffolded. So AI, for example, is building a huge amount of change. AI tracks, for example, let's talk about Pearson's wonderful product, actually. They have this JEE preparation thing, right? They've gone retail now. And that tracks a lot of your performance along strands using machine learning and AI, they say. I don't really know why it needs AI as such, or whether that's a pitch. But that's a great product that helps you track your performance. And again, move up the learning value chain. So, yeah, you are saying that's not really AI, aren't you? I am only telling you what I've been told in their presentation. So there's a lot of simple stuff like that's happening. And I will call this simple, because it's about tracking. It's more administrative as such. There's a lot of wonderful stuff happening in the neurosciences. So you have biohacking that's quite mainstream right now for health. You will have biohacking for learning very, very soon. So not just devices embedded in your body to track how much you've learned and what you've changed. We know so much more about the way our brain responds to a certain different ways of learning, response to stimuli. So we will be able to include a lot of that learning into what we do. So a lot of it actually translates all the way down to teacher training. And yeah. and what you see, what your teachers used to call the method in the class, that I have to follow the method.
Yeah.
Or I have to follow the lesson plan. In the classroom, it sounds like a lesson plan. Where it comes from is, say, where it will come from now is through the neurosciences, saying that you will be able to hack memory by doing these 15 things.
Mm.
So you will be able to, in early years, for example, NLP, which is language and hypnotherapy, is used to reduce anxiety in students.
Okay, so by NLP, you're not talking about natural language processing, you talk about neuro-linguistic programming.
Yeah, they're both called neuro-linguistic programming. The guy just stole the term from computer sciences. This is mumbo-jumbo science, right? Right now. It's mumbo-jumbo science that's actually was hypothesized, was sold a lot. But there's actual science happening. There's lots happening down the road from you at Stanford, for example. So there's definitely going to be a lot of that. All of that will be delivered through your phones. I mean, if you can have an ECG on your smartwatch now, think of what you can do with learning, how much you know about something. Though, of course, the key question still remains, the fundamental question that has never been answered for 200 years is, what is that point at which learning has happened?
What does that mean? So can you expand that question a bit? I'm curious to see. Just what do you mean by the point at which learning happens?
You may want to edit this out of this thing because it'll become less, it's not a very sellable, marketable thing. But at what point of time do you know your alphabet and not know your alphabet? Where's that difference, right? There's a certain point when somebody's sitting next to you and saying A, B, C, D, or teaching you phonics, or teaching you how to build a racket, a squash racket that's behind you, right? So what is that point at which you're saying that I am not and I am? Can you actually literally pinpoint that moment? Is there an SI unit of learning? These things don't exist, right, in education theory and learning theory.
Right.
But once you make it into a neuroscience kind of thing, all of these things will have units of when a person knows this thing and when a person doesn't know this thing, right? Because the way the brain reacts, they have color-based studies that, right? Whether the brain turns yellow, whether it turns red, how it's reacted to the stimulus, how much it has reacted, how much it has retained, how much of that electrical impulse has been triggered. So we're going to get into the science of education now in a way that we got into the science of diagnostics and health between the 60s and 2000. So the science of education, that hacking with actual understanding of what's happening to learning, is only going to start in the next 5 to 10 years. We're at this amazing, and you guys are going to build it, actually. Your generation is going to build it. So we will be able to give you the philosophical questions. We will be able to bring you back to reality in a way, saying, you know, hang on, this is not how it happens for everybody. Or will this work for that child in the village?
Yeah.
We will be able to ask you those questions. But you'll be building these things that you'll be calling hacks at the beginning, but that will eventually become the science of learning, that will eventually become scalable via technology. So when we say a lot of your jobs are going to be done by robots, a lot of the learning process is also going to be done by the technology within us. As an exoskeleton embedded or as a technique, it doesn't matter. I mean, there are three different ways that will happen. But that is the future of education. The classroom itself and the hub and spoke model, it seems will still remain important. Why? Because of what's going to happen in the next 2 to 5 years, which was your more immediate question. And that's about social and emotional learning. So what we've learned, and this is the more conventional answer, what we've learned about learning is that the moment of learning is literally a social and emotional moment. You remember things for which you have either a social or an emotional memory. You remember moments where you failed. I did not manage to crack that thing in that exam. I'm never going to forget that concept again. You remember things where you won. You remember that moment, that slam dunk in tennis. And that that technique, the way you held your hand, is that a squash racket or a tennis racket behind you? That's a tennis racket. So that moment where you made that slam dunk, you're going to remember the angle of your hand, because that was an emotional moment of victory. So our memory is triggered by emotional moments, and our memory is sustained, and our learning and application of it is sustained by social moments. And that was proved by the MOOCs. Because when MOOCs were delivered only to individuals, they created absolutely no impact, either learning impact or in terms of progressing the cohort or the individual, until there was a cohort. And then MOOCs started self-organizing into learning groups, which was all online. Of course, it was all using technology. Some were physical groups, very few of them. But once learning groups happened, once learning became social and there was peer learning and there was engagement over there, that is when MOOCs actually began to deliver value. It was only 5 years after that they could start asking for money for certification, right? Till after they could prove value. Massive example of, I think it's in Peru, in the mountains of Peru, and this lady has been awarded and has been the Minister of Education over there, where peer learning of students in primary schools has been proved to be far more effective. Why? Because it creates, and this is a movement now that's across the world, because it creates social and emotional learning moments. And that's when retention application begins to get triggered. That's when creativity and on all of your 21st century skills get triggered. You're communicating, you're using critical thinking because you're asking questions. You're able to build an entire holistic skill set if you put social and emotional learning rather than rote learning at the center. Again, still a role for rote, no doubt about it, but it's not the center of the conversation. So yes, social and emotional learning is what's going to happen in the near future, in EdTech as well.
I think this is key, because when I look back at moments where I feel I've either learned something really well or applied something I've recently learned, it's almost always been in these study groups where we're trying to solve this tough problem together, and one or two people, like I'm with one, and it's weird how if the number increases, at least in my case, if it's a lot of people, it doesn't really have the same impact as this sort of tight-knit group where we're all at the same level as far as the subject goes. And so we all bounce ideas off of each other, and when we crack that problem, it's pretty fun. Yeah, that moments, those moments stand out. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, the evidence-based science of that, or the theories of education, continue to evolve, and this is again, as these theories evolve, as the evidence gathers. Again, in education, it normally, between evidence and practice in the classroom, it takes about 2.5 to 3 years, not more than that. So agile learning, for example, was a very big deal about 2 years ago. Now come the pandemic, we're talking about hybrid learning, because we're all trying to build hybrid learning toolkits. And that means EduTech again to the center. But this time, with that social and emotional learning, with that perfect group. Again, how do you identify what that perfect group is? What is the ideal size of that theoretically? What is the leveling off that you are talking about? And how do you institutionally or algorithmically actually create that kind of a group? I mean, that's right now in the future of education. But when you're if you're building it now, you're delivering it in 12 to 18 months time, right?
Yeah. I think algorithms can do a lot better job than, say, an institution or people ever could, at least in terms of matching people. I don't know what you think. This is my opinion.
Like innovation, it can't be an algorithm for algorithm's sake, right? So of course they're useful, but they're only a tool. They're only a tool. The real questions have to come from real moments of value creation. Don't let the algorithm lead you. That'll be worse than the exam leading your learning.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind, and I hope our listeners also keep that in mind. So if you were given unlimited funds and unlimited power at this point, what educational policies would you implement specifically in the next, say, 2 to 5 years for maximum impact?
You're going to make me say this. You make me feel like Miss Universe at this moment. If you had all the power in the world. It's one of those last three questions, right? Asked to all contenders. I'm very much an advocate of lifelong learning. I do think that we should have systems that enable lifelong learning in a structured and supported manner through multiple pathways. And I think creating those structures, again, I called it heutagogy earlier, autodidactic learning. It doesn't have to be. So a little bit more than corporate training, definitely different from, or analogous to, but slightly different from or more supported than, say, a computer science person learning a new skill every 3 to 5 years because it becomes redundant. Not just that. So, for example, I have taught in my class, I used to teach access to business as well. A 70-year-old professor who retired as a professor of French because he wanted to start a business, and therefore he was in my class to learn business. Now, that's amazing capacity for renewal. So if I had everything possible, so I would be focusing on the policies that build renewal for young, old, anybody. I mean, completely universal. The opportunities to renewal would be first on my list.
Well, I'm glad that I'm glad to sort of encapsulate this podcast with this advice from you, which is lifelong learning. I hope that I'm able to keep that up, and I hope that Aman's going to keep that up, and that's implemented soon. I'd love to do that. Thank you so much for being here, Meeta. We loved having you.
Thank you very much for having me.